Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everybody. In describing our work today in modeling wheat plant height, many people have been involved over the years, and I'd particularly be remiss in not adding to this list of authors Al's work, Steve Benzinger's, and Wally Wilhelm's, among many others I could mention, but those in particular. I think we owe a bit of gratitude for Al for both initiating and organizing this symposium, and it's obviously a continuation of efforts that a number of people have been working on for at least a decade or so. And I think our first two speakers have alluded to some of the problems that we've dealt with is how to transfer what I'm going to call genomic noise that I seem to hear into quantitative information that we can actually use in our models in terms of understanding it. And we hope that the benefits would include determining plant parameters a priori, and also to improve the representation of model processes. And in doing so, we hope that we can better address both phenotypic plasticity of a genotype and the likely, I called it GEI, but I appreciate both previous speakers mentioning there's a management component to that as well. In putting together today's talk, I struggled with, I have 12 minutes of fame and how to partition that for what's certainly going to be a diverse audience. And what I've kind of decided to do is to try to spend some of the time, give a brief overview of the work that led up to today's work, and then as we're trying to move the work forward, present some preliminary results of 2 years of field work that we've just been completing that deal with some of the questions that we've had as we've approached this topic. And so, of course, the obvious question is, why have we chosen plant height as an example of how to incorporate genomic knowledge or genetic knowledge into our models? And one was that we thought that, at the time, perhaps naively on my part, that we understand through the knowledge of semi-dwarfing genes that perhaps we this was a relatively well-understood genetic and system, and might be a way to kind of dabble our feet into the icy water of this topic. And then there's other side reasons. I've been involved in some erosion modeling. We know that the genes have been important in the Green Revolution, and I've listed other particular reasons why we've selected this. And at the very beginning, when a lot of us were working on the shoot-grow model starting in about 1985, this model simulated each individual node on a shoot, the elongation of it. But what we did is we broke it up into four height classes, just tall varieties, medium tall, what we called semi-dwarf, and dwarf. And the problem with this model as we moved forward is we realized there was no genetic information in determining these height classes. And it was just overall based on overall plant height. So then back in 2003, C2 and A3 organized a symposium that was starting to address this issue of taking genomic noise into physiology, and we used the buzzword of global climate change and research. When I started working on this topic with Steve Benzinger and Al and Wally and Cindy Hayes, we started to say, okay, we know there's been a lot of work done on the semi-dwarfing genes in wheat, and let's start to use some of this information into creating a better height classification system than what we've done in the past. And basically, we based this on the work of Flintham et al. In 1997 on looking at the presence or absence of three of the semi-dwarfing genes. And we recognized in this process that even if you have a semi-dwarfing gene, there are plants that that have these genes that actually could be taller than some of the varieties that didn't have the genes. So that's why we started to realize the shoot grow classification wasn't working well. And then the next step in this was back in 2008, there was a symposium on crop modeling and decision support systems held in China. And Al took the lead on trying to quantify what we presented from the 2003 symposium into a model. And and we focused on just the RHT1 semi-dwarfing gene. And I'm going to very briefly, probably I'll offend Al on my description of the work that was done. I'm just trying to give you context here. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, the idea of these semi-dwarfing genes is that, and I've listed the official name for these genes, and it's the last time I will note it because I can't, it's incomprehensible to me, but the idea is that if these genes are present in the genotype, it results in an insensitivity to gibberellic acid. Therefore, processes of elongation, such as stem elongation, is reduced, and so, therefore, you get the shortened stature in the plant. And I mentioned that Flintham et al. In 1997, they did some really nice work, and they worked with isolines of different parents, and they introduced the presence of the three genes, RHT1, 2, and 3. And they looked at this, and they said, how much do these genes reduce the parent height? And in the case of if it had the RHT1 gene, it reduced it by about 22%, if I recall correctly, and of the tall parent. But a key point in this was this is under unlimiting environments, or I like Steve Benzinger's word, fully expressing environments. But I mentioned that we know that just having this gene does not necessarily let us know what's happening with plant height, and because there are other genes that affect plant height, as you might expect. The first, of course, there is a number of RHT genes, but more importantly, something like stem elongation or plant height is obviously going to be a function of many genes and processes that come together in determining that. And from a physiology standpoint, obviously growth of stem height is going to be influenced by any number of processes, carbon capture, allocation, partitioning within the plant, relative growth rates, and particularly the duration of stem elongation. And so Al, in trying to incorporate this, he created stole this figure from last year's talk that he presented. He broke it up into two classes. The tall and the short talls were height classes based on not having the RHT1 gene. And then he broke the semi-dwarf classes, those that have the gene present, the semi-dwarfing gene, into a tall semi-dwarf class, a medium or normal or average semi-dwarf class, and a short semi-dwarf class. And then he used the crop cyst model that Claudio Stockel and others developed, and he modified it. He brought in, and this part Al's going to probably cringe, but he brought in the simulating these five height classes that I just talked about, and he brought in the non-linear phenology algorithms that he developed with others and described in Streck et al. Because it's important to get the period of stem elongation in the model and correctly. Then he used there's a 0-to-1 environmental index factor. And this is based on the fraction of, down here, well, you can probably, the fraction of transpirable soil water. And if you kind of look at this curve, basically up to about 50%, I can't see it very well, about 50%, as long as there's about 50% of this water, it's very minimal effect on, in this case, it's minimal effect on stem elongation. Well, so I think the efforts that particularly Al did, the results worked very well for looking at Nebraska conditions, where we had looked at 60 different varieties that fit among those five height classes, and the model worked very well. But in thinking about what's the next steps on this, I started asking the question, and it's more out of ignorance, but the question is, if you have this semi-dwarfing gene, the RHT1, because the relationship was developed under unlimiting conditions, the question is this gene, is expression of this gene the same across all environments? And particularly if you look at water deficits, a major effect on plant height. And by the same token, do all the genotypes have the same response to soil water availability? And now from a modeling standpoint, we'd hope that the answer to both those questions is no, but suspecting there might be, the question would be, how would we modify our model accordingly? And we had a number of other questions. I listed them in red and small type. There simply isn't time to even remotely get into that today. And the question is, we had these questions. So how do we start to answer them? And that's what the next part of this presentation will be. And we went to some field experiments that I mentioned we've been doing for 2 years. And these experiments actually are part of a much broader umbrella. We're looking at limited irrigation studies. The work's done in eastern Colorado, Greeley, Colorado, near Greeley, Colorado, and we're growing four crops. But in the treatments, first of all, I'm going to focus on winter wheat, and we have a series of experiments there, and one of those highlighted is the 24 varieties experiment, where we're growing 24 different varieties. And then we have, in all these experiments, we have different irrigation strategies. In the 24 variety, what we have is a full irrigation, as close as we can get to it. Then we have a rain-fed situation, the dry land. And then we maintain some levels of soil moisture above dry land conditions, but at the particular growth stages of either jointing or anthesis, or at both of those growth stages, we give it an extra addition of water to try to basically bring the profile up close to field conditions, field capacity rather. And in doing this, I wanted to point out, we're using a drip irrigation system. It's metered, so we actually have as good a spatial distribution application of water and knowledge of what actually gets into the soil profile. Varieties, I mentioned there's 24 varieties. There's three tall varieties, Baca, Goodstreak, and Prowers. The others are presumably, going into it, my understanding was with the RHT1 gene. One of my partners in crime have wondered if there's an RHT8 in it. I don't know. Okay. And I wanted to quickly mention the precipitation events, or some caveats. Precipitation events mess up an outdoor field irrigation study, as we all know. We're not working with near isogenic lines, and these are still preliminary results. Now, I've got you on the edge of your seats, I'm sure. So the bottom line is, and I just put up stuff here on the statistical analysis. Just coming to the bottom line, we saw that there was highly significant treatment effects. And this would be on plant height, by variety effects, and there was the notorious treatment by variety interaction. And I'll try to give, with all this data set, I'll try to give an overview of some of the details here, and let's go back. Okay, first we can look at this. If we look at plant height, which is on the y-axis here, final plant height, I should say, and the irrigation treatments are on the x-axis, rather. We can break it up into two height classes. The green is the tall class, and the blue, I believe it is the semi-dwarf, pooling all of the semi-dwarfs. And what I really wanted to point out, for both years, we see this pattern that, of course, as you have reduced soil water availability, you're going to get reduced plant height. That's an obvious one. But what's important is that if you look at the percent reduction of the semi-dwarf class in relation to the tall class, up to a fairly reasonable level of water stress, we're getting about the same percent reduction. But when you get to the dry land, what you see is that there's much closer relationship between the two height classes, and what you get is a very precipitous drop in the tall height class. And the same, how do we get it? And if we just go into a little bit more detail, where we still have the same tall class, and this is for both years, And we could break it up into the three height classes, the tall semi-dwarf, medium semi-dwarf, short semi-dwarf. What you see is the same pattern. I don't think we want to read too much more into this. Again, there's differences in the years of precipitation events, and it gets tough to sort that out in a presentation like this. Very quickly, 47, got it. We've got joining to anthesis period. It's very critical. We see a general decline in this with water stress, and when we tie that together with the relative growth rate, I won't go into how we determined it. We see that for the full treatments here, we get a significantly higher growth rate. The others basically seem to be about the same. I wouldn't want to do it. I won't talk about that. And conclusions. The first question was, is the RHT1 gene expressed the same across environments that differ in water availability? I don't think that's likely. Again, there's the caveats on our data set and what I've presented, but I don't think it's expressed the same. Is the response to water availability the same among genotypes? Yes, often it was. I didn't show that, but not always. So we do have the G by E interaction. This is the clinker, and how do we modify our models? Didn't have time to go into that. And I didn't get to this last one. So that was the whirlwind tour through plant height modeling of wheat.